Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Hey, Jess, how are you, man?
I'm doing well. How are you, Ken?
Good, very good. Very good to see you. So where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Columbus, Indiana. Current population, I think, is around 20,000. Back then, when I was growing up, I was a kid, probably around 15,000. It's about 40 minutes south of Indianapolis, Indiana. Columbus, Indiana, it's famous now for, you know, our current vice president, Pence, is from there. Okay. I remember him as a kid growing up.
Really?
He's running for city government and stuff, and all signs everywhere, and he was in parades and things like that. So I remember him. So it's kind of weird seeing him up there, some hillbilly, as a vice president.
Wow, I don't think of Pence as a hillbilly. Seems pretty, you know, interesting.
Well, if you knew where I grew up at, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very closed-minded there. Not a whole lot of diversity when I was growing up, at least. Yeah, it was very, very small town. Everyone knew each other there.
Yeah. What, how many Asian kids and how many Vietnamese kids did you grow up with?
There's a lot of churches in Indiana. So the Bible Belt there, a lot of sponsorship from the first wave of Vietnamese in 75, the refugee camps. Right. And I think Pennsylvania, is it Indian Town Gap?
It is.
Right.
That's where my family went.
Yeah. So that's where mine as well. And, Indiana is right, very close to Pennsylvania. And then there was a church that sponsored probably, I think, like four Vietnamese families, but we weren't close to them.
No, why not?
Because my dad was crazy. Hmm. Dad was South Vietnamese Army, got wounded in combat during the Vietnam War. But it stems beyond that, you know,
yeah.
His trauma from, you know, the military. I think it was very rough growing up during his time, his era. I think a lot of abuse, physical and mental abuse from his father, from what I hear. And then, yeah.
Did you know your grandfather?
I knew about him. I knew that he was he won some boxing championships or something in Vietnam, and I don't know much to be honest about him.
Yeah,
I know he was a player, he was a womanizer.
Your grandfather?
Yes.
Yeah,
but I think it was typical for that time era,
yeah.
Right.
It was yeah. Normal, yeah, it was normal.
Yeah. Drinker, and he ate, you know, poorly, and he died young. I think he died in his 50s or later 50s, basically from poor diet, right?
Yeah. So when you were in high school and you weren't, and I'm going to ask these questions because I kind of, I know your background, but I've never really had a chance to really ask it because I think it does have a lot to do with where you went later in life and where you are today. So I want to go back and pick up sort of like your high school. And I've always wondered, you didn't grow up with a lot of Asian kids. Did that kind of affect how you formed in terms of your identity as an American or Vietnamese American? How did it shape you?
That's a good question. And I'm smiling because it did. It had a huge impact. I mean, I grew up, I thought I was white. I wanted to be white. Because that's what, everywhere I looked was white people. I didn't know any difference. I had my family. That's it. My friends were Caucasian. So yeah, definitely it formed, you know, my perception of my identity.
Did people fuck with you?
Well, hell yeah, they did.
How so?
I remember going to the mall and saying, you know, a guy would walk by and put do the slanty eye thing, walk by or call me gook or things like that. But within circles, like in high school, everyone knew me, my sister and I. So I wasn't really messed with in high school. It was more in the outside community, like all the hillbillies and stuff. I'm sure there was racism with my school, but no one really said anything to me. No one really picked up on me. Because I do remember, kind of oddly enough, a black guy would pick on me. Actually, two black guys. Like, there was like maybe four black guys in my school, and two out of four would pick on me.
Right.
So, which is, I thought was weird. But yeah, it did formulate growing up around white people how I thought and my perceptions.
When you got picked on, because I think of you as one of the toughest guys that I know today. What? But back then, how would you react?
Dude, I was a pussy back then. I was very timid and quiet. I would just look at them. Look as in, I can't believe you said that to me. I'm a human being. Why would you say something like that to me? I'm one of you. I'm trying to be like one of you. Why are you putting me down? Right?
Now, that statement is crazy because that I'm trying to be like you, it drove me, it drove you, and it drove so many of us to join the U.S.
Yes. military.
But if you think about it, if you think about how silly and kind of like morbid that is, it's fucked up beyond what we can imagine, right? Like, these are people that pushed us around and as we're growing up, but right. Yet we want to join the ranks of, so why do you think young Vietnamese men would join the military, join the Marine Corps of all the branches of services that you're right. Hanging out with all these tough white guys, and why would you do that?
Well, I think it goes beyond, I'll answer your question, but I think it goes beyond. If you think about society as a whole, they want to be lighter skin, right? The complexion, everyone's striving it. And all the ethnicities, strive for that, it seems like to me. Kid, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Something happened. Anyways, all ethnicities seem like they strive to do that and be lighter skin complexion. I think for us, I can speak for myself, a Vietnamese guy growing up, middle of America, seeing these white people, this is like kind of like my idol. This is what I'm trying to be. I'm trying to be like, because these white people they're happy. They got nice girlfriends, they got nice cars, nice homes, whatever the case may be. I want to be like them, right? And what best to join the military, right? And especially the Marines, the few, the proud, the Marines, the most difficult military branch there is, right? Hey, I can be like one, or I can be like them. I can be the best, right?
What made you join? What inspired you to do that?
Not to go to jail. I think out of my identity crisis, I guess, as a teenager, every teenager has one. I think I was a big struggle with my dad, dealing with my dad and his PTSD, his drinking, his abusive nature behind, all those issues. I rebelled a lot and got in a lot of trouble. And then ended up in foster care for a while.
I didn't know that. So wait, foster care, how old were you?
15.
So how did you get into foster care?
I was hanging out with the wrong crowd. I think, teenagers, kids, they act out. They won't talk about things. They act out like negatively. They get in trouble. They do delinquent behaviors, or the case may be. And that's what I did. I was delinquent. I stole scooters with a group of my friends, the gas-powered scooters, and we would ride them. And we got caught by the police on a stolen one and put on probation. And I was in the probation office with my father because I was a minor. My parent had to be there. My dad was like, I disown you. You are not my son. To me, I was like, in front of everybody. Yeah, yeah. To me, I was like, that's normal shit, right? My dad said that stuff to me all the time. I disown you. I disown you. You're not good enough. I was like, yeah, okay, be Vietnamese, whatever, right? But when I see the Vietnamese culture and I'm trying to be white people don't do that, right? So I was kind of happy, dude, they took me out of the home because I'm trying to be white.
But who took you out of the home? The government.
Yeah, the county.
So when your dad said, I disown you, they decided to take you out?
Yeah, they knew that. His demeanor, the way he was saying it, was very serious. And it's like, hey, your son is getting in trouble because of your ass, you know, basically. You know, I had a partner too, but, you know, I was a kid. And they put me in a kid's shelter. And from there, I just got funneled through the system.
Whoa.
From 15 to 18. I'm surprised you didn't know that, dude.
No, I didn't know that. So, wow.
Yeah. I guess I don't share that with everyone. It's like, hey, I was in foster care.
So how often did you see your mom and dad?
Depends, man, what situation I was in. I didn't see him much throughout those years because I think they were shameful. And frankly, I didn't really want to talk to him. You know, I remember being very depressed as a kid. It's like, why don't my parents just love me? Like, I see my boy, my friend, who's white, and his parents are hugging him.
I love you.
I'm sorry?
I love you and all that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just those, you know, being vocal instead of, you know, cussing you out so you do better because I'm cussing you out because I love you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is how our parents did it. So I saw that, and then I wanted that. And then in foster care, obviously I never found that. But, you know, and I found that in the Marine Corps, though. I found that love that I was yearning for as a young man, 18, 19-year-old man. I found that. Even though, I mean, remember our drill instructors, they would scream at us and just yell at us, but they took care of us. They made sure that we ate and we slept, you know, our basic necessities.
Yeah, you can feel the love.
Yeah.
You can feel the love. You know, when you start listening to so many of these military, US military stories of why people join, so many people come from broken homes. So many people come from fucked up backgrounds. And you realize that people are just really fucked up before they go. And then when they get into war and out of war, they never really cleared up what was going on before they got in the military.
Yes, yes.
So many of us are fucked up. And we never cleared up. And we just let it fester. But we'll get into that, I'm sure, in the next, in our conversation today. That's primarily what I really want to talk about is the mental health side of life. You hear all these SEAL team guys, and it almost feels like the harder you grew up, the more shit you wanted to get into, right? Like, guys like me, I didn't have it as bad as you, so I didn't want to punish myself in the military. But then you hear about, like, your story, all these other guys that are in SEAL teams, and you're just like, wow, the more punishment, the better, so because they want to feel something.
Yeah.
So then, okay, so you're still in foster care. You go to school. You're going to high school. You're not seeing your parents a whole lot. What kind of grades were you getting in? Why would you – how could you even finish high school to join the military?
That's a good question. I didn't.
Oh, wow.
I didn't graduate high school, man.
I didn't know that.
When I was 17 – I think I got in some more trouble. I think I was smoking weed or something and then just kept on popping on your analysis. I think that's what happened. Anyways, so I was always kicked out of school, man. I mean, I didn't like cause harm to anybody. I caused harm to myself. But I was never that type to go out and like have chaos and, you know, whatever. I just smoked weed and I liked to drink. And then the probation officer wasn't okay with that, or foster care workers weren't okay with that. So I ended up doing time in boys school. So I went to a facility, a lockdown facility. It was prison. I was there for 2 weeks. And then after that time there, they sent me to a lower level boys home where re-entry into, you know, community job. And I got my GED there. Then after my GED, I got out, I turned 18 and started working in a factory for a couple months and living in an apartment, sleeping on the floor and just partying. You know, I had my car, I had my apartment, and I had my factory job.
What kind of factory job did you get?
I made car speakers. Okay. So if you think about Indiana, very industrial, a lot of car manufacturing and stuff evolving around, you know, manufacturing for cars, you know, there's always factory jobs there. And then I, you know what, I experienced racism there in the factory. But I was at the point in my life where I wanted to take action for like people saying things to me. This guy said something and I said, excuse me. And he didn't have the courage to repeat from me. And I'm glad he didn't at that time. Cause then I think I would have physically assaulted him and got in a lot of trouble. But yeah, that's how I got my high school diploma, GED.
And then at what point did the Marine Corps pop into your head?
My best friend joined the Marine Corps. I knew you were in the Marines. I knew your brother was in the Marines. And like a lot of, I just thought the Marines was cool, man. You know what I mean? And after he went, he came back, he changed his life. It's like, I'm going to go. But I couldn't because I had a GED. They don't accept GEDs in the Marine Corps. So I had to take a year of college. So I went to IU Bloomington, Indiana University, did some summer semesters there, and went to some community colleges up there as well to get enough credits to offset my GED so I can enter into the Marine Corps. So, yeah, that was my change of my life right there.
All right, so you go through boot camp and did you sign up as an infantry person or is that something that was just handed to you as you enrolled?
No, I didn't start as infantry. I start as enlisted boot camp, MCRD San Diego, signed up for the engineering field because my mind was, I just want to do 4 years and get out, have some type of skill, right? For a future or something like that. But I end up doing boot camp and becoming a bulk fueler, basically a gas station attendant. I fucking hated that job. I felt like the biggest pussy in the world. Here I am in the Marine Corps. What do? I'm a bulk fueler. What the fuck is that? I pumping gas and kicking ass was our motto. That's stupid.
Did you have to go to school for it?
Yeah, man, believe it or not, man, you got to go to school to learn how to pump gas.
And how long was the school for?
I think it was like a month, man.
Yeah.
MRS school is like a month in Fort Lee.
And once you got to the fleet, how long were you doing bulk fuel for?
I did my entire first enlistment, 4 years as a bulk fuelman.
I had no idea. I thought you were an 0311 your first year.
No, man, you didn't, bro. Because when I came in, you were processing out, right?
I got out end of '96.
Oh no, your brother was processing out because I came in at '98.
Yeah, he got out in '97, end of '97, I believe.
Okay.
I got November '96.
Oh, I see. So I came in '98, did my 4 years as a bulk fueler. I did 4 years active, finished my tour in Iwakuni, Japan, then came back stateside and then moved back home to Indiana.
Oh, you gotten out?
I got out. And then my parents divorced while I was in still. So I came back to Indiana with my dad. My mom ended up moving out to California. This is probably in 2002 timeframe. And then... my last year I was in, 9/11 happened. It was so weird, man.
Wow.
I was in Iwakuni when 9/11 happened. I was in the barracks, and you know, I think it was late at night. I remember I was drunk, I was passed out, and then my roommate wakes me up. He's like, "Hey, man, look at that!" So I look on TV, I see these planes flying into these buildings. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I didn't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, whatever. But next day, it was very odd. The Japanese were all manning the perimeter of our base, the Japanese military, and just looking at us as we were walking by, because it was serious, right?
Yeah.
But that time, I didn't think it was that serious. It was just kind of surreal to me. It's like, mm-hmm. okay. But then we had to increase our security measures on the base. So that's when it started to get real. When they gave me a 50 cal.
You know, shit was real.
I was like, okay. They're giving me a bulk fuelman, a 50 caliber, instead of a gas nozzle, right? So I knew that the shit was real. The shit was crazy.
I mean, what do you mean they gave you a 50 cal? You went down to the armory and they handed you a 50 cal? I mean,
no, they got Humvees. They mounted 50 cals in Humvees. It's like, you guys need to set up a tour, some type of security schedule to guard the base. Gave us live rounds and a 50 cal. When you think about it, we're not infantry guys, right? And then we're operating a heavy duty machine gun. Machine gun that we haven't messed with probably for years.
Yep.
So that was kind of scary, man. Just that thought, you know.
Yeah, because we shot 50 cals in MCT, right?
Yes. Yes.
But it's like what? Like a day or two with the 50 cals. It was like a big deal at the time. Yeah, it was just like a day. Yeah. Everybody's like jumping up and down. That's the only time you ever shot a 50 cal.
Yeah.
If you weren't 03.
That's right. That's right. So I decided to get out. I did my 4 years. So I decided to get out. I wanted to go to college. Went back to Indiana, lived with my dad and his girlfriend, joined the reserves, the Marine Corps reserves, and they activated because that was Afghanistan was going on, I think 2002. And then towards the end of 2002 into 2003, the operation, you know, Iraqi Freedom occurred.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called when we came over there, and then they changed the name again. Anyways, it was Iraq 2003, the push from Kuwait all the way to Baghdad. I was part of that.
And you went back in as still a bulk fueler, or you went under a different MOS at the time?
Well, I was in a reserve unit, so I was still a bulk fueler in a comm unit, a communications company. Oh, mm-hmm. So I didn't know any of their shit. But I wanted to deploy with them. I wanted to be with the boys, you know? So deployed with them, a comm company, 1st Marine Division. And, you know, here's a bulk fueler. They're like, we have no need for you. I mean, you're a bulk fueler. You're supposed to be like, you know, logistics or in a wing support unit, you know? But in a division, we really don't have a need for you. So they put me on perimeter security with a Marine Corps band. Do you know during wartime, the Marine Corps band, their function is perimeter security for division? Did you know that?
No, it's so weird and counterintuitive.
Yeah, so, the band, Marine Corps band. That's their job.
I think back in the day, I heard like back in the day, like hundreds of years ago, like the bands would go out into the battlefield to, I could be way wrong.
Yeah.
To play to keep the troops motivated, right?
Right.
That would make sense. If you put the band on the perimeter, it's sort of like.
Yeah. I see the correlation you're making. Yeah. But whenever the president declared, like, you know, operations were over, the band would play. They brought their fucking instruments to combat. Can you believe that shit? It was weird, dude.
Nuts.
It was so weird.
So wait, so you get to Kuwait, or you get where you go to Iraq? You fly into Iraq.
You fly into Kuwait.
Kuwait. Okay. What? So what happens?
It's like chaos. Like, you get processed. You scan your ID card with the army's there to process you.
What month was that in 2000? End of 2001 or 2002? How quickly do they reactivate you?
I think January is when they activated. January 2000, three is when they activated us.
Wait, so that's a year later then, right? Because September 11, 2001 was 9/11. So over a year later, you get reactivated and called in for
the push.
To push.
Yeah, I call the push. Yeah.
So in January, you get back in.
Yep.
Of 2003, and you go to Kuwait.
Correct. And then I think in March, that's when operations kicked off. That's when we started storming north towards Baghdad.
And you were in that push? You were in that
storm? I was in that push, man. They gave me a Humvee, and again, they gave me 50 cals. I don't know, man, this 50 cal thing. I was stuck with 50 cals again. I was a sergeant at the time. So I was in charge of perimeter security for my sector. My sector to tie in with the Marine Corps band. and then we drove, I can't remember how many miles it was, but we drove in Humvees, tanks, and whatever we were in. It was all blacked out. So no headlights, nothing. And we used night vision goggles to drive. Keep in mind, Iraq is obviously not like the United States where there's street lights and stuff and paved roads. It was dark as shit. The roads are not like ours. They're like, we had to drive off road in some spots, and some spots there were no roads. And the thing is, I've never driven a Humvee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Humvee's like a car, but I've never driven one. And to drive one with night vision goggles is quite a task. I've never done that before, so I learned real quick.
Were there IEDs around at that time, or it hasn't really, there was not a proliferation of IEDs yet?
No, there were mines at the time.
Mines, okay. Yeah. So were you worried? Like, because probably now when you're driving in those kinds of environments, you think about IEDs, but in 2003, it wasn't a big thing yet.
It wasn't a big thing yet. I wasn't, you're more, I was more concerned about dudes shooting at me versus anything like that. Because I knew the threat was people shooting at you, the Iraqis. Tanks weren't a big threat because our tanks destroyed them. Our anti-armored, it's like that, you can't mess with us, man. Basically what I saw was a carnage from the infantry guys. By the time I got on scene, I mean, there was like, it looked like hell just broke loose.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's from our guys.
Yeah, our guys just fucking shit up, man. We destroyed some shit. I think the most interesting thing I saw was a Cobra attack helicopter. It was cut in half. It looked like there was no tail to it. It was just sitting there. I don't know how the hell that happened. It was just sitting. The scene in Full Metal Jacket where they're storming through the city and it's on fire.
Yeah.
I saw, that's what my experience was in Iraq.
Everything's
on fire and shit like that.
How many Humvees are going in to the city in your caravan?
My convoy, I don't know, maybe like 50, but we were all rolling up. Multiple units were rolling, man. There was like thousands of us. It was like a sea of us. It was crazy. If I was, the enemy, I'd be scared shitless. That's why most of them ran. Most of them didn't fight us at that time during the push.
Yeah, so there was no return fire or anything crazy.
Well, there was, but not like, a full-on battle.
Yeah.
They were scared. I mean, Saddam screwed them, dude. I mean, he didn't train them well, and they weren't well equipped. They were hungry. They really didn't want to fight. Mm-hmm. I think most of the guys were like, what can the Americans offer us? More like,
Shit. So when you rolled into the city, were there already bases or anything? What was set up for you to...
There was nothing set up. When we rolled in the city, it was us setting things up. I think we rolled to like... it's called the Bath headquarters. Mm-hmm. Saddam's, the Bath party, into their headquarters. It was a huge compound, four-wall compound. It fit the 1st Marine Division in there.
Holy shit. How many guys?
That's a lot of people. Yeah. That's probably like, 2,000, 3,000 4,000 people, maybe.
I mean, so you just roll up and there's like 2,000-3,000, and like, who's setting up the beds? Who's setting up all the food and the logistics?
No, dude. No, man. We're living out our vehicles still. We're living out of guard towers. They're guard towers. It was very austere.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Just live out of your car, man. It's like camping, right?
So you have all your gear with you, and for how many days are you living out of the Humvee?
See, I don't remember time frames very well. I do remember this. We had to wear mop suits. So It was March.
Tell me what a mop suit is.
A mop suit is basically like, if you think about a mechanic, he wears a suit, right? He works on cars. Think about that, but camouflage and lined with charcoal. So we were afraid of a chemical attack by Saddam. So we wore these. And imagine wearing rubber boots, a chemical suit, and fighting and moving around. It was so uncomfortable.
And with headgear.
Well, when there was, you know, when we had to don the gas mask, we had to wear it. Yeah. But we're more on a protective posture whenever we didn't move around once we had our gas mask on.
So you're in mop gear the whole time, like once you get into the Ba'ath Party headquarters?
Yeah, once we got there, that's when we took off our mop suits. So I'd probably say a couple of weeks we were wearing mop suits. I don't remember the timeline. Somehow I kind of forgot timeline of what actually happened. But I remember the mop suits very uncomfortable because it started getting hot.
Yeah. It doesn't breathe. I remember wearing those mop suits too. And at Pendleton, it wasn't that hot because you know, I went through May or June. It wasn't that hot, but I can't imagine in Iraq in the desert.
Once we occupied there, and I don't really know politically what was going on. I just know, like, no one was shooting at us anymore. You know, there's no pop shots here and there. I mean, basically, we were securing everything. But we did take a tour to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. It's one of the seven wonders of the world.
Yeah.
Right.
But what do you mean what do you mean we took a tour? Like 2,000 2,000 guys took turns to go check out the Hanging Gardens? How did that work?
So I guess the CO of my unit had to go do something around that area. One of Saddam's palaces were near the seven the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and we took a two, you know, Humvee convoy up there, and we just toured the place. We toured Saddam's palaces, and it was kind of weird, man. You know, just touring Iraq after, you know.
Wait, what did you see at the palaces?
Well, most of them were looted by the locals, but just marble and gold lined walls and chandeliers that had gold in them. They were just immaculate. They're so nice. There's pools. Saddam lived in some pretty nice palaces, man. Yeah.
And when you guys toured it, were there already U.S. Marines on guard and, you know,
security? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then, so what your company, you said your company commander and you, or?
His security detail, and I was part of it.
Okay. So you guys walk around and was there other officers there that kind of like took your company commander and said, hey, let's walk around, check out the, I mean, what do you, how do you just roll in, park the car, walk around?
Yep. Yep. There's
no senior officers saying, okay. And then they take you on a tour, or you guys are just free to go wherever you want.
We rolled together, you know, in like little groups and just walked around. I mean, we had a rifles and like a magazine with like 30 rounds. That was it. Because I guess our mindsets were, okay, we've been through the worst. All right. There's no more fighting as of now. So we're cool. But boy, were we wrong, you know, thinking back.
What do you mean?
I was a sergeant at the time, and then me and Lance Corporal would roll around, just he and I in a Humvee in the local population. We got so many care packages that finally caught up with us because we ran out of supplies because we're moving so fast during the conflict. Eventually things caught up with us. I would take all the stuff that we didn't use, extra razors, you know, all this extra stuff caught up with us. We didn't know what to do with it. We didn't want to burn it. So we went out in the city and we would drop off boxes of supplies to the locals.
Wow.
But fast forward down the road, you know, insurgents repopulated areas, you know.
So wait, fast forward like a year later or a few days later?
No, a couple of years later.
Okay, because that's on your next tour, right?
Yeah, that's my next tour. I came back from Iraq in one piece. Didn't see a whole hell lot because it was so fast. The Marine Corps infantry fucked things up by the time we got on scene. So then I think I continued school. Yeah, I continued school. I want to get my bachelor's degree. I want to be a dentist. Mm-hmm. Just like any typical Asian, I guess, right? Some type of doctor or some shit. I wanted to do it. Not because my parents kind of pushed me. And at that time, my mom was in Indiana. My mom was in California. My dad was still in Indiana. I left my dad's home, moved up to Indianapolis, and went to school. And finished off with a bachelor's in arts and humanities. With some, you know, cookie cutter fucking degree. Because I hated to be on the civilian world. I thought civilians were nasty. I thought they were disgusting. Had no discipline. Had no moral courage.
Yeah. So, I want to get into all of this stuff in terms of, because I've always stood from afar, because I transitioned a lot earlier than you did when I got out. Yeah. And I never really fully bought into, I mean, because you were in a different situation with the units that you were a part of. I wasn't in those combat units, so I had a very different mentality. I tell my friends this all the time. I had the discipline from the Marine Corps and the mindset, but when it came to certain indoctrinated ways of thinking, it never caught on to me. And I feel like such a Californian and very liberal in my thinking. And I always watched you and I'm like, when is he ever going to slip back into civilian life, you know?
Right.
So you do college and you graduate and you never really feel like you're part of the fabric of civilian life, right?
Right. Definitely.
But you're still a reservist.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Navy reserves. I jumped over and joined the Navy reserves.
But why didn't you, you didn't do any ROTC programs, I mean, during the time, or you just stayed as enlisted reserve?
Enlisted reserve and just get a degree and then get my commission. I went on a commissioning program at the local recruiter's office to become a Marine Corps officer. So as soon as I graduated, it took me like 3 years to get my degree. Graduated, got my commission, and got married for the first time, mm-hmm. right? Got her pregnant, then got married.
Yeah.
Just some girl I met working in a factory, you know, while I was going to school. Then off to Quantico, Virginia.
Wait, but you're still commissioned. You said you were a Navy man. You're in the
Navy. Yeah. Yep.
So you're getting commissioned. Wait, I'm confused. You're going to Quantico for Marine Corps officer training, right?
Correct.
But how are you part of the Navy at that moment?
Because after I got back from Iraq with the reserve unit, I was so disgusted with the Marine Corps. I don't know why. I just was. So I decided to rebel and join the Navy Reserves and finish out my college degree being under Navy Reserves. And then when I got commissioned, I obviously had to break that contract with the Navy, which was fine because I was going active duty. Went back to the Marine Corps, went back to my roots, but as an officer.
Wait, so how long were you in the Navy for?
Like 2 years.
What? And how do you know what to do in the Navy? Like,
I didn't give a shit I was a Marine, dude. And everyone knew I was a Marine.
I know. It's the weirdest thing. Why would any Marine go? I mean, it's like, God, I hate to say this to my Navy brothers. But you don't go from the Marine Corps into the Navy unless it's, you know, you want to do SEAL teams. But did you have to learn to the uniforms over? Like, isn't there a different protocol in the Navy? Or you just sign the paper now in the Navy? How does that work out?
Well, there is a different protocol, but I didn't give a shit about that protocol.
But you have to go to training, no?
Yeah, drill weekends, I went.
I guess what I'm asking is you don't have to go to boot camp all over again. And
not from Navy, no. Because number one, because you go to Marine Corps boot camp, that supersedes everyone's boot camp.
I can't imagine it does. Yeah, I can't imagine you have to go to Navy boot camp again. But if you go to Navy boot camp and you want to become a Marine, it's a totally different animal, right?
Right. Because you have to go to both boot camps, Navy, and then you go to Marine Corps. Marine Corps. So, I mean, when I was in the Navy Reserves, dude, I was such a – I thought I was a badass, dude. I had this ego about me, and you can't fuck with me. And the chief, which is like a – I think it's E7.
E7, yeah.
Chief was E7. He would tell me what to do. I would look at him like, yeah, right. Whatever, dude. They would try to counsel me into this and try to talk to me. The Marine Corps, they put your foot up your ass, right? Yeah. But I knew they're a bunch of bitches, so I just kind of did whatever I wanted to. But when we had a project, a mission – I was in it, man. I was in it. And that's why I stayed with them. That's why they kicked me out, because they knew I was undisciplined with them. But when it came down to like a mission, I was all for it. I was there.
What was your MOS in the Navy?
I was a builder. I was a CB, a construction worker. We built a sub. Well, the biggest project I did while I was in the reserve was we built a subway.
Like
the sandwich shop Subway.
No, you're joking. You're fucking with me, right?
No, dude, seriously. We did the framing for a Subway shop.
What was that all about?
Because it was on a military base, and it was a project, so they had us do it.
So fucking random.
I know, right?
Subway. I'm like, oh, you built... I think the first thing I'm thinking is you build a submarine, right?
No.
Fucking build a subway.
Yeah, man. Subway, sandwich shop. Yeah, so after that, then I went to Quantico, went to boot camp again.
Well, that's, yeah, but that's for officer training, right?
Yeah, which was a joke because I went enlisted, right?
Yeah, so is it, it's not more, it's not harder?
It's harder as in physical. They push you harder physically.
Really? Yeah. Why do you think they do that?
Because you're leading by example. You can't fall out of a run or fall out some type of physical event. You know, you're a leader. You have to be up there showing your Marines like, hey, we can pull through this, you know, whatever we're doing physically. And there's some leadership stuff, but mainly a lot of physical. So.
So how many there has to be a lot more people that fall out and drop out of Marine Corps officer training than boot camp training, right?
Yeah, but you have to get screened prior to going, first of all.
Okay.
So you can't meet like I think you have to have a first class PFT.
Really?
Yeah, you have to. Which I think is like I can't remember the criteria, but to me that was easy because I ran almost perfect scores. So officer boot camp was simple for me. I enjoyed it because I've been to boot camp before. And another thing is I'm known as prior enlisted, and there's other guys as well that are prior enlisted there. And we always bonded. We'd watch these college kids get all scared and shit from the drill instructors. But ironically, there was a drill instructor there that was there when I was enlisted boot camp, was a drill instructor there as well. So the same drill instructor was there. He wasn't my drill instructor, but he remembered me. Whoa. I don't know how the fuck you remember me.
Yeah, thousands of kids going through.
Yeah, how the fuck do you remember me? Because I didn't get in trouble at Marine Corps boot camp. I didn't stand out. I barely got IT, you know, got hazed, doing push-ups and stuff. Barely. So he remembered me. So as an officer, you know, a candidate, he would fuck with me, but I knew it was all good fun. Yeah, I wasn't scared of them. Fucking... You know, I was equivalent rank to him, pretty much.
Wait, so while you're they're called Mustangs, right?
Yes.
Okay, so as a Mustang, are you in boot camp wearing your insignias?
No, you are not just
stripped down.
You're scum of the earth like everyone else is. There,
no right? Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of the staff there, the drill instructor and the platoon commander, there on staff, The Marine Corps was so small, man. They knew my previous bosses, or they knew, you know, something about my career that I had enlisted.
At that point, was it only one tour you did in Iraq, or you?
It was one tour.
Okay, one tour. So they knew, like, you went to the other side, you came back. So there had to be some level of respect for you.
Oh yeah, definitely. But you know, it was, they still yelled at you and treated you like shit. But it was funny. I mean, I would lose my bearing a lot and just laugh at them. So I thought they were funny. They're cussing me out, and I'm looking at them like, I know it's a show, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I would like smile at them. I was like, right? Just imagine doing that in enlisted boot camp.
They'll kill you.
Yeah.
You would never dare to do that because you really don't know what the next minute will look like, especially in the 90s. Like, they put hands on you.
Yeah, during your era, yes.
In the 90s, in my era, I went in 93. Yeah.
Oh man.
I was stretching one time. I had both hands on a bed, you know, and then the rest of the platoon was doing something else. And I was the only guy, I wasn't thinking. I was stretching my calves out before a run.
Oh no.
All of a sudden I feel like this hand on my back, and I look down and my t-shirt's ripped off. He just grabbed it, and he pulled back and he ripped my shirt off. And I was like, Sergeant Rosenbaum. He was an intense dude. Yeah. So you're not wearing any insignias. You're nothing. You're not an E5. You're nothing.
Yes.
But you do have that respect that these DIs give you, these drill instructors give you, right?
Yes.
Other than the physical side of it, the mental probably wasn't anything close to the enlisted side, right?
Yeah, it was fun, dude. And you know what the fucked up thing about it is? We had breaks. We had libo on the weekends and officer boot camp. Yes.
That's crazy.
We would have Saturday off, and then we'd come back on Sunday. So we would go out in town and get a hotel and just get drunk as fuck.
And then go back.
Yeah.
And then wake up like at 4 o'clock and do all that shit, like regular.
Yes.
You have a 2-day liberty and then you go back.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that crazy, dude?
And then do the DIs, they don't call you sir, do they? Because you're not commissioned yet, right?
No, they call you candidate. You're not a recruit, you're candidate. They call you candidate.
Yeah.
Candidate Tran.
So wait, do warrant officers go through the same thing? Or
they go not through commission officers, you know, boot camp. They go through their own little training. But they don't go through a boot camp. It's more like
they transition into CW, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's more like an officer type gentleman's class they go to in Quantico.
So what was your, did you have to redo your MOS? What was the whole deal with that?
So after boot camp, you know, I went back, and then you go to TBS, the basic school. All commissioned officers have to go to the basic school.
Okay.
But I got my degree, got my commission, then went to the basic school in Quantico. It's about a year long, and all you do is, I think it was a year long, or a couple months, whatever, but you learn all the MOSs of the Marine Corps.
Oh, and that's, wow.
Yeah, yeah. You primarily infantry, but you get a lot of exposure
to everything. Wow, that sounds like a very, for me, somebody like me, when I hear that, I think about how valuable that is. And here's why, because I mean, I was an admin guy, let's face it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you, with my admin training in the Marine Corps,
I can't
tell you how invaluable that experience has been for me throughout my entire life, right? The organization, the way you think. But I can't imagine going through S1, S2, S3, S4, logistics, supplies, every branch that covers every maneuvering and workings of the way the Marine Corps ran.
Right.
And how long is that school?
I think it was about a year. But then after that, you get selected for your specialty MOS, your so MOS.
So you don't know what your MOS is going in?
Nope.
Wow. So you have to go through TBS.
Right.
And then they kind of like look at what your aptitude is, and then they figure out where your strengths are.
I guess it's more on you, what you want. And then if you're, you know, the commander, the platoon commander, that's in charge of you guys, believes like you're a good fit for that, and there's a slot available, you go. So that was 2006. So if you think about the conflict that was going on, Fallujah happened already, Ramadi, the heavy fighting over in Iraq. I think the heavy fighting was starting to die down around 2006 timeframe. So I picked infantry. There was so many slots for infantry because a lot of guys were getting killed over in Iraq. Or
why did you pick infantry?
Because, man, that's got to have big balls to do that, man, right? I want to be tough. I want to be the tip of the spear. I want to be...
When you think back on that decision, do you think, like, that's some young man game shit? That's some young man thinking?
Yes, but now it's more of like, I'm proud. I'm proud to be... I was an infantry officer, man, you know? How many people can say that?
A big deal, man. Yeah. The big fucking deal. I mean, everything from the physicality of it to the mental, emotional demands of that position. It's not many people that can. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Then I went to my MOS school was Infantry Officers Course, like one of the hardest military trainings in the world. Right. Good time. There's a lot of things I cannot say about that training. It's secret. I think
really.
We had an oath. But Nathan Fick, I think his name is Nathan Fick, he wrote a book and he revealed some of our secrets of our training.
How do people look at him? Like,
that's a piece of shit. It's like, can you sell out?
Yeah.
You sell out, dude. I mean, it was hard, dude, but it was hard. It was hard. It was hard training.
How many weeks of it?
I think it was 3 months. But basically, it's an add-on to the basic school if you're going the infantry route. Because you learn a lot of tactics already, you know, in the basic school. But you just fine-tune infantry at the, infantry officer's course.
Yeah.
You know, completed that, and then I selected my duty station in Hawaii. That's when actually you came to see me. Remember?
Yeah. Yeah, man, K-Bay.
Yeah, but... I wasn't there very much. I was always either training and getting ready for a deployment. And then went to Iraq back in 2008. Went back to Iraq in 2008.
Okay. And when you go back to Iraq in 2008, was that a wartime thing? Or
That was war.
That was the second Gulf War, right?
If you want to call it that, yeah, you can say that.
Yeah. So what happened? So you're in your unit. And things you're training for a year or two, and then the war breaks out.
No, it was still ongoing.
Still ongoing. Okay,
from 2003. Still going, yeah. Yeah, but the dynamics have changed. Now we have IEDs, right?
Yeah.
Now we have insurgents.
Insurgents.
We have, you know, a smarter enemy that's not going to face us head on. They're going to hide with the population and attack us from there. They go hide back in the population, right? So that was, but in 2008, it was kind of dying down because there was a transition of power that was trying to occur with the Iraqi officials. And Petraeus, we were under Petraeus at the time. I was his first lieutenant, and I was a platoon commander at the time. And I had an area of operations that I was working with the Iraqi police. But what we did there was we bought the enemy was our friends because we paid them. I remember carrying a backpack full of American cash, and every month we would pay these people called Sons of Iraq. And these Sons of Iraq were basically people in these communities. We paid them to watch over their own fucking communities. Isn't that some stupid shit?
What? Wait, yes. How much would you pay them?
I don't remember, man. How much I paid them? I can't remember.
I mean, $1,000, $5,000, $30,000.
It's like a couple hundred, I think. But we're doing this around the entire Iraq area, you know. So that's $100. Yeah,
buying off
goes a long way.
Yeah. You're just basically buying off community leaders.
Yeah, pretty much.
To not fuck with you guys. I mean,
yeah, pretty much. Hey, you're our friend. We'll give you money.
And don't shoot us, or have people stand down.
Yeah, it's read between the lines type shit. But come on, we're giving you money. Don't fuck with us, right? Isn't that shady, dude?
How does that? I keep wanting to ask you at every junction here, but I gotta ask you, how does that make you feel about your service? How does it make you feel about like the reality of war, the reality of like this idea of like service to our country? Does that fucking flip everything upside down?
Yeah, it does. But my mindset is like, man, fuck this shit. I want to kill these people. I want to, you know, I'm a Marine, dude. I'm ready to fight these people. I want to kill these people. There's so many times I had to temper my guys because they want to kill them.
Why did you want to kill people? Why did you want to kill them?
Come on, can't think about our training, man. From day one.
I get that. No, I totally understand. I completely understand day one training. I get the indoctrination. But what did they do to make you want to kill them? Or is it just like in your natural training, you're in your habitat, you're like a lion, you just want to eat them?
Yeah. Well, that.
Did they provoke it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Americans, we're ethnocentric, dude. It's just, that's just the way we are, right? I mean, you come to this third world country and then our agenda is trying to push democracy off of them and they're not complying, right? So, I mean, it starts from the top. I hate to say it. They wouldn't comply. You know, these are just...
Yeah, when you say we're trying to push democracy on them at your level, at a lieutenant, what can you do to push democracy on these people? Like, what are you there to do?
Well, my specific job was to train, you know, the police as a security force, but in similar methods that we do. But the democracy piece was like securing elections, all right, so people can vote. Trying to set up a way of life that's kind of similar to ours. The thing is, these people have been ruled by a dictator for forever. They are used to the strong hand on them, right? Mm-hmm. And here we are trying to do democracy. It's just not going to work, you know? And it hasn't. You think about it, it still hasn't to this day.
Yeah.
So our mindset is like, fuck these people. We know they're just using us. Fuck, man, give us a chance to just shoot them.
Shit, man, that's heavy. That's heavy. Yeah. All right, so how long are you in Iraq for that time?
7 months.
Seven months. And do you see a lot of action?
Only action that was in my platoon was my vehicle hit an IED on my side. Fortunately, it was a failed, just the blasting cap exploded. So the blasting cap goes into the bigger explosive to ignite the bigger explosive.
And that
whatever my, yeah, just the blasting cap went off.
You could have died.
Yeah, potentially.
You could have died, yeah.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
And then got back to the States, back to Hawaii. I think that's when you came actually to come visit. Then I started the work up again to get ready for Afghanistan deployment.
Oh shit!
So 7 months later, after I get back, I go to Afghanistan.
So Afghanistan is starting to heat up at that point, right? Because we
I think we were there and. What 2001, right after 9/11, and then we started to have another presence again. I went back in 2009, I think it was 2009. Things were pretty heated. We were in Helmand Province, So Helmand Province, if you think of just geography wise. Afghanistan is surrounded by mountains and in the middle is valleys. Mm-hmm. Hamlin Province was in a valley, a very fertile area.
Yeah.
Very good for growing.
Agriculture, poppy. Agriculture,
right? Pop, exactly. And that was the cash crop of the Taliban. That's where we're at. The area that we're at, my company, I was the first lieutenant executive officer at the time during that deployment. My company was the closest to a Taliban village, Marja. And we didn't have enough forces to go take all the Taliban in that village. It was a big village. And a company's like 100 some guys in there. We couldn't have taken a village over. We had to wait for battalions to come take it over. So we were there for a couple of months on our own. And our mission was to basically go close to the village as possible, fuck with these people, and come back to our base.
Fuck with them and come back? What do you mean by fuck with them? Like just shoot them up?
Go probe their lines. There's no way we could have taken over that village. We know that. The ratios were bad. There was like, you know, thousands of people there to like 100 of us. There's no way we could have fought them. So we'd go close to their homes, you know, their village, shoot at them, get little firefights, and then go back to our base. Yeah, you give me that funny look.
What's the point of it?
Yeah. Exactly. That's a good fucking question. What is the point? I don't know, man. I mean, to show a presence, because we knew a big operation was going to occur with multiple battalions to clear this entire village. So why are we as a company going to go fuck with them? And I was cool with my boss. My boss was kind of the laid back guy. And I was an XO dude. I ran the shit there. I'm not saying to float my boat, but.
No, but XOs run the shit.
Yeah, right. So I ran the shit, man. And then my boss was like, battalion would call and he'd be like, yes, 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 we'll do this. We do this. We do this. And sucking their dick. I'm like, come on, man. So why the fuck are we going out there for? All we're doing is putting Marines' lives at risk for no reason.
Did anybody get hurt?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, dude. This deployment was hard on me because
this was our third deployment.
My third deployment. And I, as an executive officer, you know, I had to implement what my CO implemented, you know, orders he gave me and the battalion. Right. And then our orders was to do these stupid ass patrols. You know, four line of troops, you know, that's what we called it. And getting these little fireflies. And we knew there were IEDs out there. There's a shit fucking shitload. We knew it. So a battalion's going to have us send patrols out there into an IED area. For what fucking reason? So my opinion, my thought process is looking back at it, it's because these officers want to look good on paper, right? Like, hey, the Marines went out there, killed X amount of people, blah, blah, blah. You know, report to regiment, you know.
Indiscriminate firing at the people in the village.
It's not indiscriminate. I think it's, we did have rules of engagement. You know, it's, I mean, think about it, dude. If someone rolls up in your fucking house and you're going to shoot at them, right? And they're trying to come and come at you and attack you. You're going to do the same thing.
When I think about our experience and my service 4 years in the Marine Corps and your time, I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface yet. And I think about all of the veterans that are homeless in LA or throughout the United States. It just breaks my heart. And it's something that I really wanted to talk to you about today and get really into the work that you do today at the VA and get your thoughts on it. But I feel like I haven't gotten enough. I mean, I could go for 4 hours talking to
you. Yeah. Right, right. I mean, I see what you're trying to say in transition to, but, you know, that deployment fucked me up.
Okay, that third deployment to Afghanistan really fucked you. That was the one that changed you.
It changed me because not necessarily because of the direct fighting I was involved with.
Yeah.
It's more of like ordering these men to an area where I knew was dangerous. And I couldn't do anything about it. I had to order them to do it. And then one guy, Miner, I mean, he was a good guy. He was a good Marine. He was a corporal. I met him when he was a fucking private. I watched him grow up in my company. He went out there and got blown the fuck up. So basically the IED split his body. He was still alive. reports where the guys were shoving their knees up in his abdomen, trying to stop the bleeding, because they had hope, this is going to live. Everyone liked him. He bled out and died. Half his body was still in the battlefield. So the guys had to go back out there and get the rest of his fucking body. So they went back out there. They got it. They brought his body parts to me. It was so weird, dude. It was like, I still remember this day, the smell, and it was still warm. It was heavy. Your leg is heavy, right? I don't know how many fucking pounds it is, but it's heavy. So I the sergeant came up and just gave it to me. I mean, I didn't want him to look in the bag because he already had to fuck with it. I grabbed it, and I was looking for, some serialized equipment that, because he got blown in half pretty much. I got to find his rifle, his night vision goggles, his radio. So I'm going through all his shit, and like, there's his leg here. It's nice and warm. Helo's landing. They want his body parts.
Oh, so it just happened.
Yeah, it just happened, man. So after that, I was an officer, man. So I'm hardcore, man.
Yeah.
No emotion. So, oh, shit. Sorry, minor. One down. So the rest of the deployment continued. I think we ended up losing like two or three more guys. But when they died, it was like nothing to me. I was like, okay, carry on. What's our next mission? Right? Our next mission. So I get back after the deployment.
Back to Kaneohe?
Kaneohe. Then I'm up for orders. I choose 29 Palms, California, because I want to be an infantry trainer. Out in 29 Palms, because I been to Afghanistan. So I was there, got a lot of marital issues. Drinking was bad. Had nightmares. Didn't understand what the hell they were about. Drank my ass off.
Did you ever get help, mental help at the time?
No, dude.
Nobody caught it? Nobody?
It wasn't, PTSD was, it wasn't, it's known in the mental health community, but it just wasn't common in the military community at that time. We're at the height of Afghanistan right now, man. And you talk about PTSD, what the fuck is that? We didn't know what that was. I wasn't in direct combat per se, right? So I do the 29 Palms thing. I'm training every day, getting infantry battalions ready to go to Afghanistan and do what I just did, right? So I'm playing war over and over every fucking day for the next 2 years. I start drinking a lot, flipping out, marital issues. Then I start getting suicidal.
What do you think was going on in your mind at that time and during those 2 years to make you go, I'm going to kill myself?
I don't know, man. I mean, just, I guess the value of life, being an infantry dude, that's, you kill people. I mean, we don't value life, in a way. So I don't know. And somehow transitioned into my own life. And I think alcohol abuse had a big part of that as well. And
man, how many guys do you think go from that? Those infantry guys go from that to become police officers?
Probably a lot.
A lot.
I think a lot.
A fuck ton.
Yeah. I know some now that are fucked up.
And they don't get cleaned up. They don't go through therapy. They don't address their trauma, do they?
Some. Most don't. Because if you do address that, they're going to hire you, right? It's a barrier, dude. It's a huge barrier. And, if you want to go that type of field, that type of work.
Yeah.
I didn't even try. So I got out, dude. I was flipping out. I was getting in trouble. MPs are at my house all the time. I got 5150 psychiatric holds like three times. I tried ODing on pills one time. That didn't work.
But at the entire time, where's the commanding officer? Where's your commanding officer saying, all right, Trent, go get fucking help now. Go down to medical and figure this shit out. Did anybody?
It wasn't common, man.
Wow. It's like, I can't imagine that.
All right. So go see the psychologist, psychiatrist, get on meds. okay, just go do that. Go do that stuff. I was kind of like, okay, not a big deal at the time. I wasn't taken seriously, you know what I mean? But it got to the point where I was too out of it. I needed to focus more on me. That's when I think, so I was a captain at the time.
Yeah.
My boss was a full-bird colonel, and he was like, he's a good guy, a former Green Beret.
Did he get it?
He got it. Eventually, he got it. He knew. His first impression was, Tran needs to work more. That's what he needs to do. He needs to focus on work. So they gave me all these projects and tasks, and that just was making it worse for me. Yeah, and then they knew, like, I'm done. He's done. He needs to help. Let's get him over to the naval, you know, people, have him help him out. Medically retired me, you know. Got out, didn't have anything, went through a divorce, filed for bankruptcy. Ex-wife took the kids, didn't have shit.
How many kids did you have at the time when you got out?
Two.
Okay, so how old were they when you left or when you got divorced?
I think Jesse was like 7, I think. Justin was like maybe 5.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Do you look at them now and see the effect that you had on them as a result of where you were at the time?
I don't think they saw, well, maybe they did see a lot, but I don't think they saw a lot. A lot of things would happen at night because I didn't like to sleep. I'd stay up and drink. So all my craziness happened at night. So I don't think they saw a whole lot.
But I mean, you had to have shut down psychologically. How could you have been present with their children?
Oh, I wasn't. You're right. Yeah. I wasn't.
Now, do you look at them now and go, they're detached? Are they detached? Are they, do you think they've adjusted, or do you think it's there's still like some trauma from your trauma passed down to them at the time?
I think they adjusted because of the career field I went to. You know, I took a year off when I got off. I got out of the Marine Corps, lived with my mom. That was kind of humiliating, right? Captain, living with his fucking mom, no career goals, nothing. Rode my bike around a lot. I joined some veteran groups to ride bikes. Then I just decided, like, I want to be around veterans. I want to. I just want to help people. And then I got accepted at USC to the social work program.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was there, and you know, I took it very serious.
What made you decide to go to USC for that for a program like that?
What
program did you go to USC for?
So, I got a master's in social work, but the reason why I had a lot of options, you know, I had friends that were applying to Harvard and Ivy League schools and getting their MBAs and things like that. And I just didn't feel it in my heart. I felt like a compassion to do. I was compelled, I had some compassion to do something to like help somebody. Because in the Marines, my job was to find the best ways to kill other people. So I wanted to do the opposite. And I didn't want to go down the doctor route because I was my early 30s at the time. I thought being a doctor would take too damn long. I just didn't feel like it. So I saw social work. It's like, okay, it's a master's program. Get done in 2 years and start working. So I did that. Went to USC, got my master's. My goal was to work with the VA the whole time while I was at school, but the cards didn't work right when I graduated. So I started working for the county, LA County. So I worked for LA County Inpatient Psychiatric Unit. So I dealt with like the crazies you see on the side of the street. They get picked up. I did that for about 4 years. Then I got my license. Then now presently I work at the VA. I work with homeless veterans now. Oh, okay. So I'm back home. Circle. Yeah. Everything, all my experiences in life
has come to this.
It's come to this. Yeah. Me being a supervisor Working with homeless veterans.
So when you say you work with them, what do you do? You sit and listen to them come in and talk to you, you know?
They're not that stage yet. I mean, maybe they are, but they're more of, they have needs, they're homeless. So my priority is to hook them up with housing and benefits. So, you know, the model is housing first, then fix everything else. So my job is to hook them up in that aspect. We're usually, my facility is, it could be the first time a veteran, you know, sees, you know, help, gets help is through us. We're the first step in the process.
What's the average age of a homeless veteran?
Well, what I've seen, the middle age, 50s.
Okay. And what are the stages? I mean, do you know off the top of your head, like, how does it go from being, you come out of the Marine Corps, come out of the military, you go get a job, but how does it go from there usually to becoming a homeless person?
Right. From what my experience is, substance use disorders, PTSD, right? Some type of unresolved trauma. But I've seen a lot of substance use disorders. Like in the military, you know how we drink in the military. We get down, right?
I remember putting away a 24 pack in one night. A regular. Yeah. I can't even finish a beer today. 24 bottles in one night was a normal thing. Sometimes I go to 30 bottles in one night. I mean, it sounds crazy today, right?
Right.
But that's what we did.
But imagine the guys that continued that when they got out, right? It's fun. It's fun for a while, years maybe, but then it catches up with you. Failed relationships, income, loss of jobs, housing, whatever.
Yeah.
And they're homeless. You know, recently I've been getting some guys with PTSD. I mean, I think a lot of the Vietnam War guys have kind of circled around and got help, or they're dead. Right.
They've aged out of the system.
Yeah, pretty much. But now it's my generation and I'm starting to see them, you know, untreated PTSD. But I think what's been good about society is this push for getting help about PTSD.
Yeah, it's normal now. It's It's accepted, not normal. It's more accepted than it was when we were growing up.
Right. But according to the PTSD clinic psychiatry director, only 20% of veterans with PTSD get help. Only 20%. And then the average suicide a day from a veteran is, I think the number is like 22 or something like that a day. Imagine that. 22 veterans
a day kill themselves.
And what, the veteran population constitute what? Like 1% of the population or something very small like that? You know,
when you think about those numbers and you look back, man, I feel so guilty when people say thank you for your service, right? Like, okay, like we did some time in there, but do you fuck, man, I know this is like not a politically correct thing to say, but do you feel like it was worth it? Like for these people to have, I don't even know if I'm asking the right question. The pain and the suffering that it causes. Okay, you lose a limb, you die out in the battlefield. That's one conversation, right? But to come back on this unresolved like mental issue and mental health problem, that's not worth it. That can't be worth it, right?
You know, you do have a good point. What I've noticed, guys that are freshly out, you know, within a couple of years or so, they're very anti-military. You know, majority of them, from what I've seen, the older guys, there's a lot of pride involved. Mm-hmm. Even though their life is shit right now, whatever, they're homeless, they still have pride. They have pride. So I guess the cycle occurs, you know. I mean, you get out being angry at the military, like, you guys fuck me up, right? Then eventually it comes to, you know, pride down the road. For some, I guess, that's what I've seen.
And, you know, to add all this shit, you know, to add up all this like weird thought about it being worthy or not. We're Vietnamese. We're not even white. I mean, that's something like we don't even talk about, right? I don't know if any of my Vietnamese American Marines have ever talked about this shit. I have a group call with my boys, the guys that I served with in 93. There's like maybe a dozen of us, and we keep.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking to them. I'm going to be talking to them, my brother, and two of my boys. There's quite a few, but two of my closest guys. And I'm going to bring this up. It's like our identity as Vietnamese Americans, it's weirdly tied into the history of the United States, right? But it's kind of weird when you think about it. Obviously, our family didn't come from the communist side. We came from the South Vietnamese army. But at the same time, it's like, why are we fighting why are we in that predicament? Why are we like in the military, the U.S. military? It's weird if you think about it.
Well, whenever I have thought about that when I was in, I always have to justify what I'm doing in the military. I justify as I'm thankful for the U.S. because they allowed my family here, right? They gave me my family political freedom. You know, that was my justification. Then it turned to, as I was getting jacked and getting strong and, you know, built, it's like, I'm doing this for the Marine Corps. I never did for myself. You know, I was always trying to justify somehow, some way for other things, never me. That came later on in life, but yeah, you're right. Thinking back, like it gives me more pride. Like, hey, I'm Vietnamese American and I was a Marine. I was a Marine infantry officer. I was a Marine captain. And I'm Vietnamese American. In that percentage is even a lot smaller now. Right?
Yeah.
There's not even very much. So there's like pride. For me, it's pride. And I want to continue to serve others, you know, with my experiences. And I wouldn't trade my experiences for the world.
Sure.
Right. And even my trauma and or my upbringing, my crappy fucking upbringing, which I mean wasn't that crappy, but there's a lot of abuse involved. I wouldn't trade it for the world.
I'm on a constant search to find out this whole being a Vietnamese person experience, right?
Yeah.
Like I'm on this quest to kind of define it, like kind of figure out like, what does this all mean to be Vietnamese? You know, my podcast really revolves around that. It revolves around questioning what people do at the highest levels in the Vietnamese community, both inside Vietnam and outside Vietnam. And to serve as a U.S. Marine, as a Vietnamese person, I think many of us have not really spent the time to think about our service and really and analyze our motivations.
Right.
And so now I'm going back to talk to Marines or, you know, politicians that served and trying to figure out like, you know, what was going on in our minds and how do we kind of make meaning of all of it today after so many years, you know, some of us 2-3 decades after we've gotten out, just analyzing what it did. And the trauma that our dad's generation went through in the military, because I have uncles who served alongside U.S. forces. I mean, one of my uncles was he was in the Phoenix program for the CIA. So he was like this hardcore CIA covert, like he understood.
Yeah.
He had the training. And I think he went to Quantico. He had some business in Quantico in the 60s. And,
right.
You know, our histories with the United States is so interlinked, but when you start to kind of like float inside of the academic world with Vietnamese Americans, you see a totally different picture. It becomes, you know, your eyes are open to another way of thinking. I don't think we have enough time in this sit down to go into it. I want to talk more about your experience at the VA today. Hopefully we'll get on another, hopefully you come into my studio in person after COVID. And when we can have like another, you know, I hopefully we can go for 3 hours the next time, because there's so much more that I wanted to talk about. Yeah. This is our first time, and you know, we're gonna hopefully we'll do more and we'll get more into the different aspects of being Vietnamese, being in the Marine Corps. But let's go back to being somebody who's working in the VA as a former Marine. When you see the trauma of the homeless vets that come in today, what do you think about?
That's me. I was them. There was a point where I was homeless. I was living with friends, didn't have a place to go. I met a Vietnamese family in 29 Palms that would feed me. They owned a barber shop, and I just went in there and kind of like pleaded with them, hey, can you guys feed me Vietnamese food? And they fed me.
Wait, were you still a captain at the time?
Yeah. Well, all my money was going to my soon-to-be ex-wife. She cleaned the house, man. And I even applied to be a janitor when I was a captain.
What?
Yeah, dude. And the fucked up thing about it is they had me come into the interview just to find out why in the hell is this captain trying to interview for a janitor position.
And how did that interview go?
Obviously, I didn't get it, but...
Because you were fucked up. Because you came off as being fucked in the head.
I guess, but they were like, I felt like they were just, they want to interview me just to make fun of me. What the fuck does this captain want to be a janitor?
But where was the job?
I was on 29 Palms base. On the base.
Oh, it was on the base. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. But then I met, you know, people out in town, and they took me under the wing. I'm good friends with them today. Vietnamese people fed me, and that bond was automatic. You know, just because I'm Vietnamese, right? So really, really good people. And then
that warms my heart to think about that
too. Yeah. So every year when I go visit, I'll go visit and bring them like a box of like Asian pears or something.
Yeah.
They know, like, I appreciate them. Well, I hope they know. But when I see veterans today, man, it's like, it pulls my heartstrings, dude. And I know the federal government, we've got money, dude. So I try to give them as much resources as possible. Because these guys are fucking homeless. You know, they're not going to become millionaires to get free benefits to the federal government. It's just going to get them at least, you know, the basic necessities, at least in life.
How many guys make it back on their feet?
I think quite a bit, man, because, you know, in the medical charting, you know, when I work with county, you would see the same patient over and over again in the charting system. They go in and out of the hospitals, in and out of the system. These veterans are, what I've seen so far is like first timers. You know, I think there's a lot of resiliency behind them. I think when they have case management structure set up for them,
yeah,
they do well, right? Because that's how we operate in the military.
But who's following up? It's you, right?
It's me or other case managers.
But if they don't have cell phones and shit like that, how do you track them?
We provide them. We find avenues to get them cell phones or whatever they need, right?
So you basically restructure their lives so they can get back in to society.
We try, yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, I have a lot of compassion for this population because I understand them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some come in and try to game the game. But, you know, these people that are trying to game the game, they're hurting. I know they are. Because why are they trying to fucking game the game? First of all, right?
Yeah.
And then for not a whole lot of money and not a lot of resources, right? So I hook them up, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very ethical about things. I don't say, hey man, you need to do X, Y, and Z. I just like, you know, I kind of guide them to these resources, you know, based upon their disabilities or whatever. Because, you know, I can try to empower them in a way like, hey, they're gonna go after this resource because of X, Y, and Z. This is gonna make me feel good to get help because I'm gonna have a clearer head, right? And then maybe I can get my family back or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But it's a rewarding job, you know, and I really appreciate it so far. I just, you know, I wouldn't have gotten to where I'm at today if I didn't resolve my own shit.
Absolutely. And that's something that I want to talk about on the next, like,
oh, of course, yeah,
on the next thing with you, because that's deep. And I think that, yeah, we have to reschedule another sit down together and maybe do another few hours, because I want to hear that side of it. I'm very interested in mental health, and I love to hear how people get better and advance. Yeah. You know,
yes.
How much of the homeless population in LA do you think is prior military?
I can't remember the numbers. Every year there's a point and count, I think that's what they call, where they actually physically go out in the community and count homeless people, and to include obviously veterans if they're homeless. I don't know any numbers, but I know I spoke to my old boss today, who's a doctor for USC, LAC USC, and he lives in Brentwood, which is right next to West LA VA. Mm-hmm. He said like he's watched the homeless population like explode out of proportion because of this corona, number one, right? And just, you know, just poverty and untreated.
Man, it's crazy here in LA. I don't know if it's ever going to get better. It's an insane amount of homeless people now. I don't see it getting better anytime soon.
Right. Well, I spoke to another veteran, good friend of mine. She is a sergeant in LAPD, and she had a special task force. She was assigned to start a homeless program within LAPD, you know, connecting, you know, people to resources, things like that. Well, they shut it down because of the cuts, the budget cuts that's happening right now. So she told me like a very conservative thought process of treating, you know, the homeless, give them options of substance abuse, you know, help. If they don't complete, go to jail.
Yeah,
you know, that's kind of conservative thought process, but
yeah, I don't know if that'll help either.
I don't know what the solution is, but for the VA, I think veterans know. I think the stereotype of the VA has gone away from my experience of like a place where they're not going to help you. It's like, you know, I am the front lines of the VA.
Yeah.
I'm the first impression that somebody gets. So I'm there all about customer service. I want them to trust us as a VA, because there's some really good people in the VA that just want to help veterans at that. Right. I see a lot of good people. So
you're a good man.
Yeah. I mean, well, thank you.
What if somebody comes in and they don't have a DD-214? Which is, I always think about that. Like, I don't have a DD-214. I got out honorably. I was discharged. I can't find my DD. Me, I'm like a functioning member of society, and I can't find my DD-214. I have an old, like, weird copy, but it's missing the. I think there's like a part A and a part B to this thing, and I can't find it. I was trying to do a home loan a couple of years ago, and they asked for my DD-214, and I showed it to them, and they're like, no, you're missing the first part. Okay. So now it always fucks with me. I'm like, well, what about these homeless guys? How do they get into the system if you don't have a DD-214, if you can't prove it, or is it already in the system? But guys like me in the 90s, everything was analog, you know?
Right. So we help them. we help get them. We reach out to National Archives and help them get a DD-214.
Oh shit. So you can help me get my DD-214.
Actually, you can go online, do yourself. But most of these veterans don't have access to anything. So we help them. Believe it or not, that's probably the number one barrier to getting housing is all the documentation, right?
So that's what I think all the time. I look at homeless vets or when they're holding a sign, I'm thinking like, that's the first thing I go to is like, where's your DD-214s at? You know, like,
I don't have that shit, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah.
How do you get anything?
We help them out. There's a lot of forms to fill out that get these items for free. And right now, because of COVID, they're expediting these forms to try to get, you know, veterans permanently housed. And they're building a lot of project-based housing. It's basically a new apartment complex that houses all veterans. It's a really good deal. And, you know, I hear a lot of good things about veterans. There's a lot of VA employees that were homeless.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a lot of them that, you know, went through the system themselves, and here they are, you know, in the capacity of helping another veteran. There's some awesome guys that I work with, and gals. You know, I'm very, very proud to work in VA, and my problem is I got to keep work at work. You know, I can't take it home.
Yeah.
I think about these people, you know, and they pull my heartstrings, you know.
Jesse, I would like to end on this hopeful note, because we moved into a hopeful stretch. But again, I think sometime after the new year, we need to get back on and we need to dive deeper, because I have like 1,000 other questions. I mean, I always have these questions for people, but I have so much more questions that require hours to get into. And I'm sure a lot of people are interested in the inner workings of your mind, your process, and how you think, and what you've gone through, and how you bring that to the table to help these vets. You know, thank you so much for your service. Thank you for your service, continued service at the VA. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing. I mean, I am blown away by how open you're able to, because I kept asking you in the pre-interviews, you know, like, hey, do you think you can open up? And you said, like, nothing is off limits. And I really do appreciate, I thank you for the trust that you have in me to sit and talk to you about this stuff.
I think when you share things and it gets out there, it extinguishes it, right? The negative connotations about it, you extinguish it. It's therapy, dude. Right? This is therapy. This is the way I see it. It's therapy.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure, man, I have to be sure that your mom and dad are so proud of you today.
Oh, yeah, they are. Yeah.
How far you've come. Yeah.
Yeah.
So have a happy holidays and a wonderful new year. And we will talk again, you know, after the new year, and we'll another shot at this. Yeah. I want to get to know a lot more.
Sure. It's a pleasure, man. It's a pleasure. All right, brother.
All right, Jesse. All right, brother. Thank you again. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran and Javier Proenza. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.